Izzy said, which is a strange way to begin anything. We wanted to bring everyone up here to have a chat. Because Stevie has something she wanted to say, if you wouldn't mind sitting down. In that moment, Stevie missed her friends so profoundly that she could have cried. Janelle, Vi, and Nate were in the sky, moving toward home, and David was here, but he might as well have been on Mars. She couldn't think about that now. This was the thing she had to do. She wished she could do it from the stability of the bench in the middle of the pod, but she had to stand at the head of it, where it shook the most, but where everyone could see her. I wanted to talk about the button, Stevie said. The one Angela mentioned in her text. Yes, Yash said, tucking himself inside his gray cashmere coat in the chill. What was that all about? It was a message, Stevie replied. A message to a friend. She was trying to tell one of you something. I could only figure out what the message meant because I happened to be there on the night she sent the message. People get ideas from things around them. They use examples they know that make sense to them. And, you know, Angela knew history. She knew all about Henry VIII and his wives. When we visited her that night, Angela told us a story about the execution of Anne Boleyn. She was telling us in a lot of detail how Anne was set up to die, and how the king ordered a special, fancy executioner from France. This guy used a sword, not an axe. The word axe was the moment the mood in the pod shifted. Stevie could feel it. Everyone got a little more attentive, more brittle. So the victim's head had to be in a certain position to do the job in one blow. He used a trick. He would call out to an imaginary assistant to bring the sword. The victim would turn their head in that direction to listen for the sword coming. But the guy already had the sword. Now the neck was in the right position, and he would swing. She said, "A little bit of fakery does so much." She gave herself the idea. Make a little bit of fakery. Get someone to turn their head. Angela had grown tired of waiting, tired of not knowing what she knew. She'd just found out that she started talking about the murders when she was on painkillers. All the pretense was gone. Now they all knew what this was. And she decided enough was enough. She wanted an answer. She decided to call her assistant to bring her sword. She put something out there. Anne Boleyn gave her part of the idea. Her cat gave her the rest. Her cat steals buttons. He tried to take one off my coat while we were there. What if there was a piece of evidence? What's a good piece of evidence? Something small that might come off clothing. She'd just seen that happen. A button. She texts that she has the button. It's just a stab in the dark. If this doesn't work, it doesn't matter. Who cares? It's nothing. It's a typo in a text. But if it does... She turned to look at the assembled. And it does, Stevie said. 7 minutes later, someone called her. And right after that, Angela put on her coat and left the house to meet this person. The fact that she went tells us something. I don't think she thought she was going to meet the murderer. I think she thought the person she was meeting with had the same suspicions that she did. But she was going to meet the person who killed Samantha Gravis, Rosie, and Noel. She was going to meet the person who unlocked the woodshed. She was going to meet the person who had the key that night in 1995 and was desperate to keep a secret. She turned to Sebastian, who blanched and leaned back.
I didn't.
No, Stevie said. There was something interesting in the witness statements about that night. Something that seemed completely insignificant at first. But if you read them back and focused on only one thing, it was instantly obvious what happened. Someone had a key. So where were the keys? Down your pants, apparently. But remember when you tried to get the cabinet open to get the whiskey? The cabinet didn't open. It wasn't because you were drunk. It was because... you didn't have the right keys. But then you got the cabinet open. And when did that happen? Stevie turned to the man who was leaning forward, his elbows on his knees, a curious look on his face. When you switched them, she said to Peter. June 23rd, 1995. 11 p.m. It had started with the girl they met at the pub. The Canadian. The American. Samantha, that was her name. Peter should have realized she was American. She had that head of curly hair. Big American hair. Big American smile. That American confidence. Julian met her first, because he was Julian. There was nothing monogamous about Julian. He flapped those long lashes at everyone, flashing those ice blue eyes, giving that look that seemed so shy. Everyone fell for it. He and the American were all over each other within minutes. Peter had watched this over his pint. Typical. Annoying. Everything was so easy for Julian, because he was born looking like a Greek god. He had talent as well. A good singing voice, a decent guitarist, and a perfectly acceptable actor. If Julian wanted to go into acting professionally, he could do it in a heartbeat. Agents had already been sniffing around. But Julian was going into law and politics, where he would also succeed on looks and charm. Peter did want to go into television and comedy. It was all he ever wanted. It was his life, and he worked for it. He wrote obsessively, studied every show, crafted every joke. He was going to the Edinburgh Festival with Yash and then to London. He knew it would be hard graft and that they'd be broke. They couldn't afford a flat. They were looking at getting a spare room in a house to share. As he sipped his pint and watched, his anger grew. His awareness that they were days from going out into the world and that people like Julian would be everywhere. Someone needed to give Julian a kick up the arse. Peter had had it. He drained his pint and left the pub, claiming exhaustion, which was fair enough. He walked home along the river, his resentment increasing with every step. At the house, he found Rosie furiously revising for her last exam. It was a bad night to tell her this news, but Peter did it anyway. He told her gently, with an apologetic tone, and he did feel bad for her. But he was also pleased by the steely look in Rosie's eyes, even as they filled with tears. She wasn't surprised, but the confirmation hit hard. She didn't cry, really. She turned into a fierce and tiny ball of Irish rage. She thanked Peter, wiped a stray tear away, and then waited in the garden with a bottle of Coke, which she poured over Julian's head on his arrival. Peter saw this from the upstairs window. It was very satisfying to watch. "Did you tell her?" Yash asked as they sat in their room that night, listening to the yelling coming from the garden below. "She knew by the time we got home. You must have."
"I thought she should know," Peter replied.
"Bad timing with her exam, but fair enough, I suppose. Anyway, Noel's been circling for ages. I've seen them slipping off together. I expect that's how this ends."
Yash was right. Rosie spent the night folded in Noel's long arms, sobbing. Probably doing other things, too, but Peter wasn't privy to that and didn't really care. The American was back at the pub the next night, and Peter was feeling better about things. Julian was sulking in the corner and didn't want company. She was pretty, the American. Maybe he should have a go and try to talk to her. But before he could approach her, Yash was there, telling her a joke. And she was laughing. Laughing and laughing and laughing. With Julian, they had simply attached themselves to each other's faces and dispensed with the niceties. But it was clear that Yash and this girl were connecting, getting along. Yash was leaning in, pulling faces, trying so hard to entertain, and the girl was giving as good as she got, gesturing and joking back. Peter watched this over his pint as well. This was less typical, and somehow more annoying. He was so sick of being with these people all the time. He loved them, sure. But he was finished with it all. The drama, the competition, the never-ending need to impress, to entertain. The next night, Peter was not at the pub. He was walking home from a long revision session for his last exam. That's when he saw her, wobbling down the slender dirt path along the river. He knew where she was going, of course. No one would have walked this far in the dark from the center of town toward Grantchester Meadows unless they lived there or were visiting someone. The girl was going to their house to see Yash. Peter caught up with her, introduced himself. She only sort of remembered that he existed, that he had been there with the others. Of course. The American was drunk and in a happy mood. It was her last night there, she explained. She wanted to give Yash his CDs back. Maybe, she suggested to Peter, they should steal a boat. Row down the river toward home. It was a stupid idea, but the girl seemed to be flirting with him. Maybe things were turning in his direction after all. So he went along with her to one of the many tiny docks along the river where punts were tied up. What happened was not his fault. It was a misunderstanding. He honestly couldn't remember all the details anymore. It was fear and confusion. She jumped up and away from him, and the boat rocked. He saw her smack her head, and she went over into the water. Suddenly she was screaming and saying something about the police, but he hadn't done this, hadn't hurt her. She fell, and everything was vanishing in this instant, his whole life, if he didn't do something. It takes very little effort or time to hold someone under. That was where it started. An ill-fated walk home. Rosie knew something. The morning after, she'd watched him from the kitchen table, asked when he'd come in. Why did she want to know that? He'd lied, of course. But now he knew. Rosie knew something. Rosie was a strong, passionate person. Once she got into something, she did not let go. There was no news of the American. Why was there no news? The cam was maybe 6 or 7 feet deep. It wasn't the ocean. How could she not have been found? Surely bodies floated. Maybe she was stuck on something. The cam was full of shopping trolleys and other things. You heard of people getting their foot stuck when they fell in. The American was in that water somewhere. Days passed, and with each one it seemed less real. Maybe it had never happened at all. But of course it did. Rosie was watching him. He saw her doing it. Peter could see so many things now, things barely visible to him before. He could see everyone's traits and movements and tics. Susie's attention-seeking. Julian's indecisiveness. Yash's need to be the funniest. Theo's fussy overbearingness. Angela's compulsive apologizing. Sebastian's sham-glam and jokes about being lord of the manor that weren't really jokes. Noel's slyness. Rosie's stubbornness. Rosie's willingness to walk into any argument. Rosie's unwillingness to back down. Who cared anymore? In a week he would be rid of most of them. All he had to do was get through this last week and they could all move on. They were going to Merriweather, which was good. He needed to get away from Cambridge. And then, on the morning they were to leave, it was on the front of the newspaper. Her photo and the headline, "Body of Missing American Student Found." Peter read the article at a furious speed and was relieved at what he saw. That was when he discovered she was American, that her name was Samantha Gravis, and that the police were certain she had fallen off a punt while drunk. Relief washed over him. He destroyed the newspaper, then he threw up. They just needed to go, get out of this house, finish packing, and leave, and the whole thing would be over. But everyone was taking so much time. Then Rosie went into town for something before they left and came back quiet and strange. Rosie never went silent. She must have seen the paper and started to put it together. That's when he knew for certain that something needed to be done. He'd been mulling it over all week in a distant way, but now it came into sharp focus. Given her behavior over the past week, Peter was sure Rosie would go for Noel's car, so he headed that way. But as he did so, Rosie turned and joined the group that was going in Sebastian's car. He didn't change what he was doing. He'd already put his bag into the small boot of Noel's car. He had to go with it. He got in with Julian, Noel, and Angela. This car contained the heaviest smokers, and it was a ride full of cigarettes and blur and pulp blasting out of the tinny speakers of Noel's shitty Golf. All during the ride to Merryweather, he smiled and nodded and pretended to be interested in whatever anyone was saying, but his mind was elsewhere. He worked out every step. The first was to get the keys. Surely when they arrived, Sebastian would set them down at some point. This turned out to be exceptionally easy. The keys were still in the door for a moment as everyone pressed inside. Peter removed them, and before tossing them to Sebastian, exchanged them for his own. Had Sebastian looked, he may have noticed the difference, but he didn't. Sebastian took without a thought. The house was already full of commotion. Peter sprinted up the grand staircase, past the paintings of the Holtkerrys of the past, the Viscounts, the ladies, the ones in military uniforms. One of the rooms he wanted was still available. It wasn't one of the better ones. It was a little small and pokey, papered in arsenic green, but it had one major advantage. It had the most direct line of potential sight to the woodshed. As he peered out, he saw Noel and Rosie still outside, conferring in the garden. Rosie looked up and saw him. In that moment, when they locked eyes, there was a communication. "I know what you did." Peter tried to be casual about it and moved away slowly, but the world wobbled. Only one other room overlooked the kitchen garden and potentially had a view of the woodshed. That room was next door, and he could hear someone moving around inside. He collected himself, pulled his cigarettes from his pocket, and knocked on the door. Angela called out for him to enter. She was standing with the window open.
"Lost my lighter in the car," he said. "Can I use yours?"
"It's in my bag, the blue one, on the bed."
He opened the bag and dug around inside until he found the yellow disposable lighter buried at the bottom.
It was convenient that she was already at the window. Even a few paces away, he could see that Rosie and Noel had left the garden, so it was safe to come to the window and take in the view. The trees utterly obscured the garage and the woodshed from here, as they had almost certainly been planted to do. He silently gave thanks to the wealthy builders of this country pile who worked very hard to make sure they never had to see other people doing work. For a moment, standing there with Angela, he considered abandoning his entire plan. There was something so lovely about seeing her there. He had always been so fond of her. Angela had shaved her head on a dare. A bit of dark brown fuzz was coming through. It suited her, brought out her freckles, highlighted her deep brown eyes. She looked sad. Angela was loyal and emotional, and he could see that she was taking the fact that this was their last week together as students and roommates hard.
"In this silver summer night, with the smell of petrichor and climbing roses, nothing terrible could happen."
Maybe he could tell Angela, tell everyone, come clean. They would help him. They would understand it had not been his fault. He was one of the nine, and the nine stuck together. There was a tremendous clap of thunder in the distance, and the rain came down.
"Do you think we'll still play?" Angela asked.
This snapped him out of any romantic revelry and brought him sharply back to the matter at hand. Of course he couldn't tell them. You can't say to your friends, "I drowned the girl we met at the pub." Even if he claimed it was an accident, Rosie knew it wasn't. They had to play. Otherwise, they would stay inside and drink, and Rosie would tell everyone. He had to make damn sure that the game went on as scheduled. He handed Angela back her lighter and left her by the window looking pensive. Peter took a quiet turn around the dark upstairs hallway, making mental notes of who had taken which rooms. He was about to go downstairs when he noticed Rosie making her way to Angela's door. He froze and backed up. He stepped into the empty room that was between his and Angela's. This was one of the worst rooms in the house. It didn't even have a window. It was perhaps a dressing room, or perhaps a room for a maid or a personal servant, someone not important enough to deserve fresh air and a view of the outdoors. There was an adjoining door to Angela's room, and he pressed his ear against it to listen. But between the music in the house and the noise of the storm, all he could make out was Julian's name repeated several times.
"Typical.
fucking Julian. And that was usually the problem in a nutshell. Then there was a heavy footfall, someone taking the stairs two at a time. It was Suze, who was always a bit louder than everyone else, and she had champagne. Good old Suze. You could always count on her to bring the party. He heard Suze directing the other two to go downstairs. He could have kissed her. He had kissed her, everyone had. But at this moment, he felt tremendous affection for her. He cracked open the door to leave the room and found that Rosie and Angela had lingered for a moment. This time, he could make out what was being said.
"I'll talk to you after," Rosie said. "Come up and meet me here after the game."
"But what's it about? What's going on?"
"Not now. It's too important."
Suze ushered them on, but Rosie turned at the last moment.
"I'm desperate for a piss," Rosie said. "Go down, I'll be there in a moment."
Suze and Angela continued to the stairs, and Rosie made her way toward her bedroom. Peter stepped out from his hiding spot, trying not to startle her and failing. She backed up against the wall.
"Rose," he said in a low voice, "I need to talk to you about something. I think Yash is in trouble."
That genuinely confused her. He saw her shoulders relax.
"What?"
"Yash needs our help. I think you know what I mean. We need to talk, privately. Go around to the woodshed. I have the key. Meet you there as soon as the game starts."
He nodded confidently and jogged down the stairs, catching the tail end of the preparations for the game. He was sweating already. He had to calm down. He kept an eye on Rosie as the game began. She looked back at him as she went out the front door with Angela. He went to the right, through the library, slipping out the greenhouse side. Best to keep a little distance. Don't stay on her heels. He was fast, though, making a loop of the house, coming around the back to the shed. At first, she did not appear to be there. But then he heard her voice. She was behind one of the trees by the shed.
"What's wrong with Yash?"
she asked as he approached.
"Not here, inside."
The rain was pounding on his head, dripping off the slicker into his face. He fumbled around with the dozen or so keys on Sebastian's keychain before he finally got the one that opened the lock. The two stepped inside. There was no lock inside, and clearly they could not be disturbed. If he tried to secure the door himself, she might panic.
"Help me," he said. "We need to keep this shut. We need to hide while we talk."
After a moment of consideration, Rosie took a rake and secured it just so, enough that the door could not be opened.
"What's this about Yash?" she said. "Are you going to try to tell me that Yash hurt that girl?"
His suspicions were unfortunately correct, and this was already going too fast.
"The girl," he mumbled, stalling for time. Words failed him.
He would always remember how she looked at that moment. The most rosy she had ever been. So short, yet she seemed about 8 feet tall. Her face rigid, her eyes fixed, arms folded across her chest.
"We saw you," she finally said.
This caught him so unready that he didn't say, "Saw what?" He said,
"We?"
Rosie almost smiled. Peter felt the foundations under his feet slipping away.
"That night the girl disappeared, fell into the river. We heard yelling. Two voices. One was North American, sounded like a girl. We came out of the tent to see what was going on. It had all gone quiet. You came down the path not long after. You were wet and agitated. I had no idea what I'd seen until I saw the paper this morning. Her picture was in it. The girl. The Canadian. She wasn't Canadian, she was American. Her name was Samantha. She was the one you told me was snogging Julian the other night, and then she got together with Yash. Yash gave her our address. And now here you are, trying to convince me that Yash did something. Yash would never."
The panic was taking over his body. He had to control it. Had to push back the black and white spots that were taking over his vision.
"I've been watching you," Rosie said. "Ever since that night. I've been trying to understand what I saw. Something happened out there, Peter. What happened to her?"
"You must be joking,"
he said, but his voice was dry.
"I'm not joking. I even asked you the next morning about your night. You lied, Peter.
You lied about when you came back. What happened, Peter?
He had to try harder, get more conviction in his voice.
You honestly think I'm capable of hurting someone? And why?
I think you're competitive, she said. I think we all are. I think something happened. I wasn't sure before. I am now.
In that moment, it was decided. Because what else could he do? What choice did he have? What happened next was much like what had happened with the American. He needed to survive. He felt the panic slip away. It was replaced by a warm clarity, a focus unlike any he'd ever felt. Now the lie was easier. It was soft as butter. The axe was leaning by the door. He'd seen Sebastian use it before to get to the loft space.
Rosie,
he said calmly. He rubbed his hand over his forehead like he was troubled, just trying to make sense of the matter. He was in a sketch, that was all. A sketch about a misunderstanding. He was playing an exasperated man in a shop, trying to explain what he wanted.
I think that you...
He moved in the middle of the sentence. Peter had always been an athlete. He was an excellent cricketer and tennis player whenever he could be bothered to play. The axe had a long handle, so as he swung, he made a long arc. When the first blow made contact, Rosie made a weird, low noise. Each successive swing got easier. It didn't take many. Axes are effective tools. When he was sure it was over, and he was heaving and sweating and looking down, the figure on the floor didn't look like Rosie anymore. It was like a sack. There was a buzzing in his head, a strange euphoria that made no sense because he couldn't be happy about this. The body compensates in times of extreme stress. There were work gloves on the shelf. He put them on and pulled Rosie over to the pile of wood on the far side and covered her gently. He found that he was talking to her even as he did it.
Sorry, Rose. So sorry, Rose. I had no choice here, Rose. It'll be all right, Rose.
He meant it, too. So sorry, Rosie. Didn't mean for this to happen. The door began to rattle. A sharp stroke of panic whipped through his body.
Hello?
Called a voice. One of the girls. It was a little hard to hear over the pouring rain and the sound of his heartbeat in his ears. He went to the door and listened.
Hello? Who's in there? I saw your light under the door. Come on, it's awful out here. I have champagne.
Angela, just playing the game. He forced himself to breathe calmly and waited until he was sure she was gone. As he waited, he had to look at the pile of logs that Rosie was under. That wasn't tolerable. He swung the axe up and smashed the light bulb, leaving the woodshed in the pitch dark. That was better. No light at all, just the sound of the rain. He leaned against the door and closed his eyes and listened to the sound.
We saw you, Rosie said.
We came out of the tent. The shag factory. Rosie and Noel in each other's arms and talking by the garden wall when they arrived. It didn't appear that Noel knew the whole story. His demeanor had been far too casual for that. But once Rosie was found, it would all come out. Noel would put it all together. Noel would come after him. Peter wiped the axe with a rag and set it down by the door, just in case he didn't make it back in time. What time was it? What was time? He checked his watch. Just coming up on midnight. Was that all? Just an hour since they ran out of the house? It could have been seconds. It could have been years. He peeked outside, found nothing but rain and the night waiting for him. When he left Rosie and the woodshed, he snapped the lock back on the door and took a few bouncing strides to the gravel of the parking area. Nature had provided. The rain washed him clean, made the blood run from his rain slicker, off his hands, off the Wellington boots. He tipped back his face as he ran and allowed himself to be soaked. He needed to find Noel, which meant the best thing to do was to be found himself, become a seeker, get a torch. He heard voices coming from the back of the house, so he moved through the trees and around the tennis courts.
Angela and Yash were back there somewhere in the topiary. He moved toward the sound, then ducked under the first bench he saw. It was Yash who came through the entrance to the topiary area, flashed his torch around, and caught sight of him. Peter made a pretense of running.
"Bastard! Bastard!" Yash said, laughing and giving chase. "And Peter's here!"
Peter pretended to trip and allowed Yash to clap a hand on him. Yash and Angela took him to the folly, where Sebastian gave him a yellow poncho and a torch.
"Go forth," Sebastian said.
"And seek for me."
"Who's still out there to be found?" Peter asked.
"Rosie, Julian, Noel, and Suze. Find them and bring them to me."
Noel was still out there somewhere. When you must find someone because your life depends on it, you will find them. The trouble was, Noel was famously good at this game. He was extremely limber and willing to go to great lengths. He also liked to climb things. He would be up somewhere. He might have scaled some part of the house, might have gone out a window to the roof. No, not on a night like this. Too slick. Too exposed. In the process of looking for Noel, he discovered Suze hiding in a wall of topiary. He wasted precious time taking her to Sebastian. After that, he broke away from the others again and began going through the woods. A tree, perhaps. Plenty of them. It would be impossible to search them all, so he would have to be lured.
"Noel,"
he called gently as he made his way through the tree line that ringed the house.
"Noel, she needs you."
For a full half hour, he poked through trees, shining his torch up into the branches. He made his way to a small orchard off the back gardens. These trees were a bit smaller and thus more promising. The branches were just as plentiful, but closer to the ground. Easier for Noel to climb up and escape as necessary. He should have started here.
"Rosie,"
Peter said, making his way through the orchard.
"She needs you."
A faint sound from somewhere above.
"Rosie needs you, Noel," Peter said. "She needs your help."
The rustling grew louder. Noel slithered out of a tree just behind him.
"What's wrong with Rosie?"
Noel asked, dropping from the lowest branch.
"There you are,"
Peter said with real relief in his voice. He switched off his torch.
"She's asked for you. Come on." "But what's wrong?"
Noel said, allowing himself to be led through the darkness.
"Have to be quiet," Peter replied. "Come on, you'll see."
They almost ran into Suze on the way, but they managed to stay hidden. Peter found that he was almost looking forward to what was about to happen. It was so terrible and huge that it bred a queasy, wild anticipation. He was aware that something odd was happening in his mind, that he was so swamped with adrenaline and champagne that he had developed an intense focus. The life-or-death moment brought forth the heaviest chemicals the body could produce. Peter unlocked the shed while Noel hid behind. He had one hand on the axe as he waved Noel into the darkness with the other. Noel never knew what happened. Of that, Peter was sure. The first swing seemed to land somewhere around his ear, his face, probably. Knocked him sideways, confused him. Peter swung and swung again. He covered Noel with the same care that he had shown to Rosie. He was back outside at 2:15. The storm was getting worse. He moved away from the woodshed in the fulsome darkness, crossing around to the opposite side of the house. Then, as if on some celestial cue, the power cut out. Everyone retreated back inside, shivering, pulling off wet slickers and clothes, wrapping themselves in the woolen throw blankets, opening more champagne.
And there was Sebastian, crawling along the floor with a candle in his hand, trying to get to some bottle of whiskey that his father loved so much.
He would need a key to open the cabinet. It was like the universe gave him a path. Or perhaps it was that life becomes simple when your choices are few. Here was his chance. Peter dropped to the floor and joined Sebastian's little play while fumbling with the set of stolen keys, looking for the one that might open the cabinet door. Triumph. The cabinet was opened, the whiskey procured, and the keys put back into Sebastian's hand as if they had never been gone. Just one more thing to do. This required being seen going to bed. He claimed that he might be sick, which was true enough, and retired to his room. He waited over an hour on his bathroom floor, trying to hold himself together and finding that he was doing all right. Theo would come around with water like she always did after a long night. He wanted to be in the room when she made her rounds. It was a good thing to know your friends so well. Within the hour, he heard Theo enter his room and call out for him. He answered from behind the bathroom door that he was fine. She left the water. Once Theo was gone, he did a quiet creep around the upstairs, checking rooms and mentally marking where everyone was. Angela, Yash, and Theo had retired to their rooms. That left Suze, Julian, and Sebastian. He took the back stairs down to the main floor and lurked by the sitting room door for a moment to count the voices he heard inside. Suze was having a go at Julian. Good for Suze. Sebastian sounded bored by the discussion. Everyone accounted for. He could now complete the cleanup. First, he would need clothes. The nine swapped and shared clothes, so it was an easy enough matter to get some from someone else. Noel would have been ideal. He wasn't around to notice. But Noel was very slender and wore vintage clothes, usually from the 70s. It seemed like a bad idea to clean up his murder scene in a tight pair of flares. He needed something less distinctive that wouldn't be missed. Julian, then. He was downstairs, and surely he had a pair of track bottoms and a t-shirt that would do the job. And if the clothes were discovered to be missing, not a bad thing. Next, Peter went back to the mudroom, where he slipped on a pair of wellies and a pair of gardening gloves and grabbed a garden spade from a shelf. He took a careful path to the woodshed, using the house and garden walls for cover. He had to work quickly. The birds were starting their dawn chorus, and the sun would soon rise. The reality of what he had done would come down, crashing, falling scenery. It would all be real. He forced himself to carry on. Just a little more, and it would all be over. First job, force the door open to make it look like a robbery. It was, after all, an outbuilding full of cannabis. He used the spade for this. It took a few tries, and he almost broke it in the process, but the wood finally gave, and the door snapped open. While it was partially a relief not to be able to see much inside, he had to check the scene. He swung the torchlight over the piles of wood, the broken bulb, the blood on the floor. He pulled the wheelbarrow out and tipped it on the ground outside the shed, making it look like someone had been disturbed in the process of taking it. The axe was a more difficult matter. Peter felt a rising nausea as he picked it up. The blade was covered in blood and things he could not force himself to look at. He replaced it where it was usually kept by the door. In a final attempt to literally muddy the evidence, he bucketed some of the rainwater from the barrel outside onto the floor, destroying footprints and washing blood into the cracks and corners. He poured more on the strip of grass and mud that ran between the shed and the gravel drive to confuse any footprints outside of the shed as well. Those wouldn't really matter anyway. All of those would be standard welly footprints anyway, and the grounds would be littered with them. They'd all been wearing wellies that night. He was about to return inside when he had a final idea. Why not add one more thing to confuse the timeline? He crept along to the front of the house and saw that there were still lights on in the sitting room. A few people were still awake. He got as close as he dared, turned on the torch, flashed it straight ahead, then turned it off and ran back the way he came. As he entered, he could hear Suze calling out for Rosie and Noel. Peter went up the back stairs and into his room. He removed his clothes and shoved them under a curio cabinet to get rid of in the morning. Taking a bath or a shower would be too loud. He washed himself quietly at the sink. Then he threw up in the basin. He got into his bed. He drank the water Theo had brought for him. Of course, the police would come in the morning. They'd find evidence of a break-in interrupted. They'd find all that cannabis. Sebastian might go down for that, and he was sorry. It was over now. Nothing else to be done. He would be a good person to his friends. He would help them through this. Peter felt nothing but goodwill and charity toward everyone and everything. He would make something of himself. None of this would be in vain. He sank into a deep and dreamless sleep.
31. The glass towers of the City of London twinkled behind them. The pod juddered. The nine sat, an attentive if confused audience.
"I'm going to tell you a story," Stevie said. "That's all I've got for you right now is a story, but it's a story that makes a lot of sense. It's a story that fits the evidence. It begins with an American named Samantha Gravis who was visiting England and pretending to be a Canadian. You all met her. Julian and Yash hooked up with her. She had your address, and she had some of Yash's CDs. She was likely on the way to your house when she died in the early morning of the 15th of June, 1995. It seemed to be a case of a tourist who got drunk and was screwing around on a boat on the river in the dark, fell, and drowned. You said your house was on the river. And you said there was something in the backyard. The garden, whatever. A tent?
The shag factory,
Suze offered, her face a marble mask of shock. Would that be the kind of place that Rosie and Noel might go when they got together?
That's what it was for.
Shagging. Trysts.
Yes?
So we have a connection. A girl dies in the river. Rosie and Noel are out back near the river. Rosie sees something that night, something she says she can't understand. On the day you left for Merryweather, there's an article in the paper saying Samantha had been found, and it printed her picture. According to the statements, you were in Cambridge most of that day. You left late, around 8 o'clock at night, which means there was plenty of time that day for Rosie to see the paper. And she did. And Rosie suddenly knows what she saw. She tries to tell Angela about it when they get to Merryweather, but there's no time. And then Rosie and Noel go out into the storm and never come back. This is the part where you all enter the story. You were witnesses to what came next. You know that Angela said the lock was off the woodshed that night. She said she saw it off the door. She told you, right? This was to Theo, who nodded.
I thought she was drunk, upset about the lie we had to tell.
She was probably both of those things, Stevie replied. But she was right. When she went by that woodshed, someone was inside, killing one of her friends. She let this settle on the group. It was not a calming kind of thing to say, not up at a great height, locked up and alone. But that was part of what Stevie needed to do. Some things all look the same, she said, like keys, right? Maybe you notice a key ring, but who notices a key? My friend was just saying that as we checked out of student housing. No one pays attention to them. When you realize that, the whole thing begins to make a lot more sense. When you arrived at Merryweather, you unlocked the door. Maybe you set the keys down when you came in, even for a minute or two. It wouldn't have to be much time.
I suppose, Sebastian said. That's normally what happens with keys. I know I had them before the game started.
You definitely had some keys before the game started, Stevie said, because everyone saw you put them down your pants. Those were not your keys. You took those. She finally looked at Peter again. His expression had not changed. You met Rosie at the woodshed, she said. You unlocked the door and barred it from the inside. The police report makes it clear that Rosie and Noel died one at a time. Rosie first. Is that when you found out about Noel? You buried her. You broke the light. Is that because you couldn't look at what you'd done? Or because you didn't want Noel to see her body when he came in next? Nothing from Peter. Stevie pressed on. Maybe it was both, she said, shrugging. At some point, though, Angela comes by. Angela sees the lock off the door. Angela was primed to know something was wrong. Rosie just told her so. Now she was getting to the part that would be most difficult for them to hear. Rosie and Noel were both dead by the time the power went out and you all returned to the house, she went on. I know this because that is when you gave Sebastian his keys back. You probably just planned on slipping them into his pocket or something. but this story of him crawling across the floor to the cabinet keeps coming up. He kept trying to get it open, and it wouldn't open. Until, of course, you got on the floor with him. You opened the cabinet because you had the keys. You handed Sebastian his keys right in front of everyone. You didn't need them anymore. But you had one more thing to do. The stage had to be set. It had to look like a robbery. You said you were sick and you went upstairs. When the coast was clear, you slipped back down, went outside. There's only about 1,000 doors, so this couldn't have been too hard. And you broke open the shed. You pulled out a wheelbarrow and a bucket. You did one more thing for good measure. You walked around toward the sitting room and you flashed a light. Suze saw it. Suze got up and started circling the pod, looking over at Peter. Yash had retreated into himself. Theo looked reflective, like she was running through the case in her head, checking Stevie's math. Julian concentrated on his hands, stretching out his fingers. Only Sebastian looked directly at Peter, considered him fully. "It probably would have worked," Stevie said. "It did work. You knew that woodshed was filled with weed. The police would immediately think that someone had come to steal it. If anyone got in trouble, it was going to be Sebastian. But then, something happens. Theo steps in to make sure that Sebastian is safe. Everyone takes part in getting rid of the plants. Your friends were helping you disrupt the scene, helping you bake in all the lies about that night. Lying sucks. It's so lonely. Did that make you feel better, having everyone in on a lie? Not just you? This was the one and only time that night that Stevie saw a flicker of something pass Peter's face. "So," Stevie said, "that was the end of it. Except, Angela saw the lock off the door. She lied to the police about it, but she couldn't get it out of her mind. Angela knew something was wrong about that night. She wanted to know what it was Rosie wanted to tell her. I know what it's like when you can't solve something. It takes over your mind. She used her skills as a researcher, and she got records and reports. She couldn't tell the rest of you what she was doing, because she had no idea who to trust. She kept her investigation hidden from everyone. But then she had to get an operation, and she's given painkillers. The painkillers made her loopy. On the night she vanished, we had dinner with her. Everything was fine until Izzy mentioned what Angela said while she was on the painkillers. Everything changed in a second. She suddenly had to get back to work and asked us all to call it a night. What happens once we leave the house? She's upset. She knows her thoughts are out there in the world. She's said them out loud. Her fears are real. She knows something is wrong, and now her niece has brought some weird American student detective. She indicated herself. To her house. So maybe this thing is going to blow up. She can't take it anymore. She gets out her phone and starts to text her friends, and now we're back to the button and Angela going out the door. Finally, after all that, Peter stirred. He straightened up, cracking his back accidentally, and looked at Stevie.
"Did you just say all that because you think keys look alike?"
Peter said.
"Because you just told all my best friends that I killed 3 of our friends. And you are basing this on the fact that keys look alike. I'm not entirely comfortable continuing this. We came here to have a memorial. And this..."
"Oh, no." Stevie cut him off calmly. She felt better now that he was talking. She liked having something to work with. Silence was freaky. "There was one more thing. Angela's purse. Julian showed me the list of what they found in it. Here, I'll read it to you." She had the photo ready to go on her phone, which didn't want to wake up right away and made her do facial recognition 3 times. "Purse contained wallet containing 40 pounds and credit cards intact. Set of keys, phone, Oyster card, new Oral-B toothbrush in package, box of Strepsils, blister pack of Nitol. Can hold 7 tablets, 6 were missing, 1 remaining. 5 large rocks. Doesn't something stand out there?"
"I'm going to go with 5 large rocks,"
Peter said. Stevie shook her head. No, you put those there. What's weird is the toothbrush. She fished around in her backpack, where she had carefully placed the curry-stained receipt she had just fished from the trash. I went through her trash the night she vanished, Stevie said, in the same way someone might say, I went to the beach because it was sunny. She bought decongestant, throat drops, body wash, and a toothbrush. She was getting over a cold the night we saw her, so the decongestant and throat drops make sense. The body wash is self-explanatory, but the toothbrush isn't. She had a fancy electric toothbrush. She didn't need a toothbrush. And why, if you were going to drown yourself in the Thames, would you bring a toothbrush? Is that what you would grab? Maybe she just left it in her bag after she bought it, Izzy said. Stevie shook her head. The cold medicine was in her bathroom, she said. She unpacked the bag at home. The receipt was in the trash. It makes sense to carry throat drops if you have a sore throat. But she didn't need a toothbrush. And the toothbrush was clearly for something because it was separately wrapped in a bag, like she was going to give it to someone. And what does everyone say about Angela? That she's so conscientious. That even though you all borrowed each other's stuff, she was the one who always gave it back. When did everyone last see her? At a party. At Peter's house, where she stayed over. And may not have had a toothbrush, so she bought one to replace it. When she went out that night, she put it in her bag to give to him. That's not something you do if you think you're meeting a murderer. She went there not knowing. Something happened.
So, Peter said, keys and a toothbrush? Really?
He looked around, but his five friends all regarded him strangely.
Well?
Yash said quietly.
If it's not true, it should be easy enough to disprove. Right, Pete? Julian's been able to get information. I'll bet things could be worked backward. Instead of looking for Angela on the CCTV, they could look for you, at your flat, where your phone was. You could do that, couldn't you, Julian? I could, Julian said. I will, tonight. I'll have your life turned inside out. It's all right, Pete, Yash went on. If you didn't do it.
Peter seemed to be churning inside. He was maintaining control, but there was a faint curling at his upper lip.
You've always been so annoying, Julian,
he spat.
Everything's always been about you, hasn't it? Who Julian was sleeping with or flirting with or cheating on. It was endless. And now here you are again, the MP, the politician.
Oh, you think it would just be Julian?
Suze said, standing up and stepping over to Peter.
We worked together to save Sebastian. We'll do the same again. In fact, how about we pry open this?
Sebastian grabbed Suze from behind and moved her away from Peter. Izzy had already whipped out her phone and was making a call.
I think we are ready to come down, Izzy said. Quick as you can, please. Someone is, ill.
32. It was just coming up on 10 o'clock, and Big Ben bonged out the hours. They were on the ground, which was a relief. The ground didn't sway in the wind. Suze had been prevented from throwing Peter out of a glass pod door. She probably wouldn't have succeeded. The pods were made for safety and were designed to withstand any attempts to be opened from the inside, but Suze had been willing to give it her very best try. The minute they got back to the ground, Peter walked off, his coat flapping behind him in the wind. Suze was, once again, prevented from following him and shoving him into the river. Now she was being embraced by both Theo and Sebastian. Julian was on the phone. Yash was leaning against the stone wall by the riverside and taking a moment. Izzy and Stevie sat by themselves on another bench watching all this.
So what happens now? To Peter?
I don't know, Stevie said. I think I'm right about what happened, but it's hard to prove. That's why doing it up on the eye in a high-pressure situation was important. He needed to be freaked out, start making mistakes. And I believe them all when they say they're going to find out.
But will he go to jail?
I think it depends on what they find,
Stevie said, looking over at her.
And we're already looking.
That was Sebastian, who came up and joined them, along with Suze. Theo went over to minister to Yash.
What's going to happen?
Sebastian said, sitting down.
Is that we're going to pursue this to the ends of the earth. There'll be more evidence somewhere, CCTV, or witnesses, something. Whatever it is, we're going to find it. He knows that his life, as he has understood it, is over. Julian may be an arse, but he's our arse.
Suze wrapped her arms around herself and considered for a moment.
He's not actually that much of an arse, really. Still has one, but he's turned out all right.
She turned her attention to Yash and Theo.
It will be hard for him. They've been writing partners for years, but we'll make sure he's all right. And
Theo had taken Yash's hand in hers as they spoke.
Look at that,
Suze said, mostly to Sebastian.
About time.
Maybe some good will come of this.
Yes,
Sebastian replied thoughtfully.
Perhaps it's finally going to happen.
Julian strode over, slipping his phone into his pocket.
Just talked to my contact at the Met. They'll have someone pull all the CCTV footage and look at Peter's cell phone records. We'll use whatever we have to. Social media, whatever. We'll find someone who saw him with Ange that night. We'll sort it.
The five were united.
You missed your flight,
Julian said to Stevie.
For this.
Stevie nodded.
Is that going to go badly for you?
Stevie nodded again.
We'll sort that. For what you did here. There's a prominent doctor.
He nodded in Theo's direction.
Who's been treating you tonight for, what would you like, a stomach bug? And there's a minister of parliament who would be happy to phone your school to explain it all.
You threw up on me, Suze offered. It was in my hair. I'd be happy to describe it in detail.
We're good at lying,
Sebastian said, leaning over and managing a smile.
We've been doing it for years.
When the five had been assured that Stevie would stay with Izzy for the night, and when they had walked the pair to a taxi that would take them directly to Craven House, the group parted ways. London black cabs were massive on the inside, practically a small moving room with a plastic wall between them and the driver, and an intercom system to communicate between the two.
Do you think Peter might come after us? Izzy said. They seem worried about it.
In truth, Stevie did not know. Desperate people did strange and terrible things.
Peter acted out of fear, Stevie said.
He killed four people to try to keep himself out of trouble. That's what motivates him. He's afraid. And now he knows he's being watched. You can't discount it, but I feel like he's going to play innocent or he'll run. They fell into silence for a moment as London rolled past. At night, it was lit up like a theater, bright lights on white facades and monuments, glowing advertisements, blue and purple neon tracing lines through the dark. Now Stevie had time to let it all sink in. She was alone, her luggage gone and only her small backpack with her. Her friends were on their way home, far out of reach. David was gone. The wave of emotion hit her with the sudden fury of a freak wave. She had to turn quickly toward the window as her eyes filled up. She squeezed her hands into fists. London was blurry through her tears. She hoped Izzy was too lost in her own thoughts to notice, but apparently not.
Are you all right?
She asked quietly.
I know what happened. David mentioned it. I'm sorry.
Stevie opened the window halfway and took a huff of the cold, minerally air to try to steady herself.
It didn't work.
I was stupid,
she said, her voice cracking a bit.
You?
I was jealous, Stevie said. Of you.
Me?
It seemed this conversation might be one of identifying who was who.
You thought, David? And me? Stevie, I have my own complicated romance going on with someone at home. It's a mess.
No, David and I never... It's never come up.
This caught Stevie off guard.
You do? She said. You never said.
There's been no time this week,
Izzy replied.
I've barely thought about it.
The idea that Izzy had a full life that didn't revolve around David had somehow never occurred to Stevie. Love made her stupid.
Last night, Stevie said, I waited for him. He never came over. It was our last night, and I left the door open, and he never came. I thought he was with you.
No,
Izzy said.
He left about an hour after you came to the door. He was talking about you the whole time.
I was too much of a mess to really listen. I wanted to go to sleep. I was so tired. But he was sitting there on the floor, going on and on.
He does that a lot. Goes on and on about you.
So he was sitting with you, telling you he was going to break up with me, Stevie said.
No,
Izzy said.
He wasn't saying that. Actually, last night he was talking about himself. I don't want to sound unappreciative. He was very kind to me all day. But by the evening, he was having some kind of personal crisis, and I didn't have the energy to help.
Wait,
Stevie said, turning to face Izzy. She no longer cared about her wet face, or the fact that snot was going to run out of her nose at any second.
What was happening?
All he ever talks about is you. He's intimidated by you. Stevie this, and Stevie that, and Stevie figured this out, and Stevie ran into the woods. Last night he was talking about what you did at Merriweather, and how he has no direction in his life, and how you're special, and he's not. That kind of thing. He does this. I was almost prepared not to like you, just because he's always banging on about his amazing girlfriend, Stevie. But then I met you.
This utterly foreign idea swept through Stevie's mind, erasing other concepts and realities as if they had been written in sand. David was intimidated. By her? David wasn't afraid of anything.
Then this afternoon he had this strange look on his face when he brought me the fire safe and he told me what he did,
Izzy went on.
I can see why you would think it had something to do with me, given that you found him in my room. You've helped me. You helped my aunt. And I need to do something for you. Something has to come out of this.
This seemed to rouse Izzy. A light came back into her eyes, and she sat up a bit straighter. There was something she could do to distract from the pain.
What? Stevie asked. I don't know what to do.
David, Izzy said, is an idiot. He's lovely, but he is an idiot. He's impulsive. He didn't break up with you because he doesn't care about you. He did it because he's panicking about losing you. I'm sure of it. He's probably back at the house now regretting it and losing his mind. Have you told him you're here? Texted him?
Stevie shook her head.
Right.
Izzy pulled out her phone and began to type. She held it up so Stevie could see the message.
You made a mistake with Stevie, didn't you? You're an idiot. What were you thinking?
A pause. Three dots appeared, retreated, appeared again. David.
I know.
Another set of dots. David.
At pub. Vodka sodas are £3. I screwed up.
David.
Gonna drink everything, all the vodka sodas.
Do you see? Izzy said. Let's go make it right before he drinks that place dry. Excuse me?
This was to the driver, who switched on the intercom. She redirected the cab to the Seven Bishops. And with that, the entire world spun around. The tears stopped. The streets of London propelled them toward David. It was all going to be all right. They reached the Seven Bishops within minutes. The smell of beer hit Stevie as soon as they entered, along with the warmth of so many people packed into a small space. Izzy scanned, then guided Stevie deeper into the crowd that gathered along the bar and filled the floor space. In seconds, she would be with him. Then Izzy whirled around, a lopsided smile on her face.
Oh, she said. He just texted. He's not here. He's at the house. We should...
Izzy had not looked at her phone or watch.
What?
This way,
Izzy said, a forced brightness in her voice.
She grabbed Stevie's arm and tried to guide her back through the crowd, but Stevie shook her off. Izzy was not a good liar. David was not back at the student house. Something weird was happening.
Pizza, Izzy said. I'm starving. We need food. I haven't eaten since.
Stevie looked over Izzy's shoulder, despite Izzy's attempts to block the view. There, in the same booth that they had sat in together just a week ago, was David. She could see the back of his coat, his head, but his face was missing.
That was because it was pressed into another.
We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of Nine Liars by Maureen Johnson, performed by Kate Rudd, and presented by Catherine Teagan Books and Harper Audio. This program was produced by Common Mode. Executive producer, Abigail Marks. Text copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. Production copyright 2022 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.